While everybody keeps a straight face with the United States and usually smiles for the camera, apparently behind the scenes, some of the European leaders are saying that Ukraine is being betrayed by the United States, and we cannot leave Ukraine and Volodymyr Zelensky alone with these guys, meaning the United States and specifically Steve Witkoff. Well, that's one interpretation of things, and there's some difficulties and some problems with interpretations and definitions, which we're going to get to. In fact, we're going to decide who's actually betraying whom and what is the outcome of this. And to assess a lot of these things, we have back with us again Matthew Ho, former State Department official, senior fellow, Eisenhower Media Network, combat veteran, and incredibly good guy. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Danny. Happy to be here.
Good. Yeah, glad to have you here, too. Always a pleasure when we get to meet. For those who may not know, Matt and I have known each other since 2009, and we used to, when we lived here in the same town, we used to meet together at a metro stop very oftentimes and just get some lunch or something like that and solve most of the world's problems. And the world is poor today because he doesn't live here, but I digress. But anyway, it's always a pleasure. Matt's always been a good friend because of his incredibly sharp mind and the way he sees things. And so we're grateful to have you on again today. So thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for all that, Danny.
Well, listen, let's just start right off the bat here because Der Spiegel was reporting. This is actually from leaked audio. It's not like somebody said this out loud because in front of the cameras, they seem to always be kind of pulling their punches, which we're going to see here in just a second. But behind the scenes, Gary, if you can roll down a little bit further than that, this is what is being said here. It was reported by Der Spiegel today. There is a chance that the U.S. will betray Ukraine on territory without clarity on security guarantees. Macron, French President Macron, said, according to the English language notes of the call that Der Spiegel has obtained, there is, he said, a big danger for Zelensky. Now, that was not clarified in here exactly what the danger was. Was that danger to his life, which, based on what we've done with some of the other leaders in the past, like in Vietnam, for example, South Vietnam, that's a question that he needs to be concerned about. But Russia's demands for territorial concessions are one of the most delicate points in the negotiation. According to the notes, German Chancellor Merz said Zelensky must be very careful in the coming days. They are playing games with both you and us, Merz said, apparently. Likely reference to the U.S. negotiator Steve Witkoff and a real estate mogul and the son-in-law of the president, Jared Kushner. Those are some pretty strong statements there, that they are playing games with both you and us, and that we are potentially going to betray Ukraine. So let me just ask you right off the top, Matt, if you're going to betray somebody, that implies that there is some sort of marriage, there's some sort of relationship, there's some sort of promise that now you may not back it. But I'm not aware, since Biden has left office, I'm not aware of any promises or guarantees the U.S. has given either Ukraine or Europe that which we may be in the process of betraying them. How do you see that part?
Yeah, absolutely, Danny. Since the Trump administration came into office, there have been no promises, no agreements, no assertions made. Now, previously under the Biden administration, there certainly were, both in private and publicly, both directed internationally and directed nationally. Remember that Joe Biden's first reelection campaign ad that airs in September of 2023 is him as a wartime president. It's his visit to Kyiv, right? Making it clear that the war in Ukraine was the fundamental interest or purpose of reelecting Joe Biden. I mean, that's how important the war was to the Democrats in terms of the election in 2024. So certainly Ukrainians looking at that, as well as all the other assurances they were given, all the other voices of support they received. I mean, going back to the beginning of this invasion and war, where, as we all know, there was a peace agreement at hand, and Boris Johnson and Lloyd Austin and others went to Ukraine and said, don't sign this. We'll give you everything you need to win it. Volodymyr Zelensky, you'll be the next Winston Churchill, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You'll be the hero of the age, and it's reminiscent. This is par for the course. There was no way it was going to end any differently than this, Danny. This is Henry Kissinger said, it's dangerous to be America's enemy, deadly to be its ally. And whether you can make Vietnam as an example, certainly we can look at Afghanistan as an example. I recall saying, you know, at the beginning of this in 2022, the beginning of the invasion in this war in 2022, that the Ukrainians are going to be the next Afghans, that at some point the United States will no longer support them because it's no longer in the interest of the United States to do so. And that's what we're seeing here in many ways.
And what do you make of this, especially Merz and also Macron, who seem to be, you know, he's dealing, he being Trump, is dealing double with us, not just Ukraine, and that he could betray. So the implication being that somehow there's been some sort of promises or an expectation. But I just got to ask, after all of this, you know, whatever, in almost 11 months in office here, how does anybody in Europe think that Trump owes them something or has even given some sort of verbal promise when he will flip-flop back and forth like lightning speed on almost any topic at all? What do you make of the fact that they seem to genuinely, behind the scenes, feel like that they're being dealt with badly?
Well, it makes no sense because it's not even just the last 11 months, right? It's Trump's entire re-election campaign. It's the sentiment of the Republican Party or large aspects of the Republican Party for the last 4 years or so, that this war is something that the United States should not be engaged in. It should not be a proxy war. You know, there are elements of the Republican Party that was very clear about that, not the Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell side of it, but the more MAGA America First side. So if Merz or Macron or Starmer or any of the Europeans, Van der Leyen, whoever, say, oh, we've been blindsided, we were betrayed, you're pulling the rug out from underneath us, shame on you. It's really a shame on them. I mean, this has been very clearly articulated by Donald Trump, both as time running for office or running for re-election, as well as his time in office, that his goal is a peace deal, is a peace agreement, is ending this war. I want to make sure people I'm clear on what I'm saying here. When I'm talking about this betrayal, ultimately the real betrayal is of the Ukrainian people. The real betrayal here is by the European leadership, by the Biden Good administration, point. Of the Ukrainian people, of using them as their proxy force in order to try and score a geopolitical victory over Russia, letting Ukraine bleed in some ridiculous, inept attempt to cause a Russian political collapse. This is something that has been a concerted effort by the United States, not just in Ukraine, but throughout the world, to use proxy forces to achieve its aims. And of course, the suffering, the sacrifice, the cost is borne on the people and the lands of countries like Ukraine. So ultimately, the betrayal here is of the Ukrainian people by the European leadership, the American leadership, and their own leadership, for allowing this unwinnable war to continue like this.
I want to continue on where there just below where Gary has highlighted, because there's two other things. One that Macron apparently said, and it seems to be echoed by Merz, where he says that there is, Macron said, a big danger for Zelensky. And then they add parenthetically, basically, Russia's demands for territorial concessions are one of the most delicate points in negotiations. According to the notes, Merz then said Zelensky must be very careful in the coming days. So it's not really explained here very much, but one wonders, are they talking about that a negotiated deal that Volodymyr Zelensky doesn't like would be agreed, so you have to be careful or you're in big danger? Or do you think that they're talking about potentially that there's like his physical life is in danger? Because I have heard lots of people speculate here in the last few days that that's something that is a legitimate possibility, that the United States or one of several other organizations or entities rather can actually take him out. And we had somebody on the show the other day that said Zelensky has as much of a danger of going out feet first as he does on his own terms. Now, I want to point out here just for our viewing audience that even though that may sound just absurd at face value, we do have some history of this. This is from the New York Times back in 1971, the U.S. In Diem's overthrow. And in the article there, it goes on, it says, in August and October of 1963, the narrative recounts the United States gave its support to a cabal of army generals, that's South Vietnamese army generals, bent on removing the controversial leader, and he was eventually assassinated. So our hands are not exactly clean on that, and there is some kind of history. Should Zelensky be worried about that?
where I would push back on the idea that the United States would remove him either by forcing him into exile or to capitulate or by killing him is that in order to secure a peace deal with the Russians is I don't know who would replace him. Right. I mean, so certainly I think that the great danger to Zelensky is in if he agrees to a deal, if he betrays the Ukrainian nationalists, the far right, the neo-Nazis, et cetera, right, betrays the Europeans and accepts a deal, ends the war, right, ends his people suffering, you know, then he has that well-established risk from within his own country, supported by the likes of, say, MI6, that he will be removed from power, again, either by exile or by, you know, execution. Certainly, we all remember the story that when Zelensky comes to power, he's elected on a platform of ending the civil war in the Donbass, of coming to an agreement with Russia, of honoring the Minsk agreement, of ending that conflict. And then as soon as he's in office, the far right, the ultra-nationalists come in and they literally point out the tree they will hang him from if he seeks to make peace with the Russians. So, I mean, there is that danger to him internally as well as, again, I wouldn't pass the MI6 or someone like that to participate or to provide support for something like that. But the question about him being removed, again, either either by execution or by or assassination or by just forced into exile by the Americans leaves me wondering who would fill his place. So do the Americans have the ability to put someone into office, to put someone in charge of Ukraine who has the political support, the capital, the strength to hold Ukraine together through what's going to be a tumultuous betrayal, again, seen by the far right, the ultra-nationalists of Ukraine by such a peace deal with Russia? You know, one of the things I look at and I say, you know, the folks who've gained the most power in Ukraine, the folks who are in the best position these last 4 years, is that far right, are those neo-Nazis. They're the ones who have the greatest capacity to carry out such a thing and then hold together a government by force. So that's my consideration when I think about it. But certainly, as you said, Danny, the history's there. You know, and one thing too, you know, no one in any of this should be trusted by anyone. I wouldn't trust Mertz. I wouldn't trust Witkoff. I wouldn't trust Umerov. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't trust anybody in any of this with anything. You know, I mean, this is like fill in the blank, whatever you want me to, you know, fill in the blank on that. That's a problem here is that like all of these people are liars. All of these people have shown through experience they can't be trusted. The one thing I think that you can go by on this is that they are all motivated by self-interest. So where do you see where those self-interests intersect? And then maybe you possibly get a deer there. But certainly, you know, there's no one who has no one who's thinking right can think that Friedrich Merz is really concerned about the well-being and sovereignty of Ukraine, or that Macron or Starmer are the same. They have their own interests at play here, just as those in Ukraine, and just as Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner do, as Donald Trump does, and of course as the Russians do. I mean, all my comments should extend to the Russians as well.
Well, that's actually what I was going to say, because there's a certain argument to be made that if you are on the side where you can tell the truth and it work in your advantage, then you'll tell the truth. And right now, right, I think it's fair to say that a lot of the public statements coming out of the Russian side are more accurate and closer to the truth than anything on the West. But we do have, and let's, you can just go back to right before this whole invasion happened in February of 2022, where Russia repeatedly for about the 4 or 5 months prior to this kept saying, we're not going to invade anybody. I don't know what y'all are talking about, right, as they move their invasion forces into place. So, you know, there's that too. But since that time, I think by and large, it's almost like, you know, what's that phrase they use, you know, integrity among whores. Sorry to be crude,
right,
like that.
Right, right,
I'm not sure who's the least offensive here, but right now I take your point that, you know, it's always about the reality on the ground is the only thing you can actually trust. And unfortunately you have the Ukrainian people and population as the bill payer for all of this mendacity. And, that's the biggest betrayal I see, to agree with you.
Yeah, you know, Danny, that's absolutely right. When you are dominating in a war, when you're winning a war, however people want to, whatever phrase they want to use to describe this, the reality of this war at this point, it's a lot easier to tell the truth, right? You know, so certainly what the Russians are saying about what their objectives are, their considerations, their rationale or reasons for such things. Yeah, they have all the capacity, all the field of play in which to tell the truth. While the Americans and the Europeans have spun such ridiculous tales, have been just reinforcing a narrative and executing policies to reinforce failed or failing narratives that give them no alternative. What's the choice now? Say for the Europeans, like a Starmer, like a Macron, like a Mertz, like a von der Leyen, like a Schoof in Holland, like all these Tusk in Poland. I mean, just keep going through them all. You know, where is it possible for them to reverse course on this narrative that they just haven't been banging on about for the last 4 years, but really for the last approximately 10, 15 years? You know, and so much of their political identity is tied up in that. And then when you look at the actual conditions of Europe, look at, one, the popularity of these leaders. I mean, the last I looked, Merz was at 25%. Starmer was at 17%. Macron was at like 11%. I mean, these guys make Trump and Biden look like the Beatles. You know, I mean, like, right? You know, I mean, like, I mean, so when Europe has such dire problems, not casting stones at Europe because I enjoy it. We have dire problems here in the U.S. too. But when they have their housing issues, they have their immigration issues, they have their healthcare, you know, issues, declining quality of living, mass deindustrialization, right? I mean, when you have all these real serious societal level issues upon which your parties are not going to deliver, for these political leaders in Europe, their choice has been for the last decade or so to tie their political identity to the great threat from the East, right? Yeah. To the idea that we are democracies fighting the autocracies, that we are the legacy of our grandfathers and great grandfathers who fought the fascists, right? I mean, like on and on and on. When that's your political identity and that's all you got, then you walk away from that. You know, I mean,
let me ask you a question. Given your experience in the State Department and given your experience, especially in Afghanistan, where trying to find, some kind of negotiated settlement was always at least a portion of what we were trying to do, at least ostensibly. How do you come to any kind of an agreement? And I mean, any kind of agreement in this war when you have, I mean, you just talked about how, you know, you don't have any trust about the U.S. and European leaders, especially. And of course, they ad nauseum talk about how they don't trust a thing that Vladimir Putin says. And when both sides are just throwing back and forth about how they don't trust the other, upon what basis can anybody bring it into this war diplomatically?
Well, I mean, certainly we can look at this over the last years of this war and see that there have been not just attempts, but actual successes at diplomacy. You've had how many dozens of prisoner exchanges? You had a Black Sea grain deal that allowed Ukraine to export its grain and other cereals and whatnot. That lasted for more than a year, I believe, up until the West refused to go through with the sanctions relief they promised on Russia, you know. And then, of course, you have the example of the March and April 2022 talks, right? You've seen a willingness for the Russians to put forward negotiators. Now they're coming from a position of strength, so they're not going to give up anything. That's just negotiations 101. But I mean, so you have seen a willingness of the Russians to negotiate and carry out the requirements of those negotiations, whether again through Black Sea deal or prisoner exchanges or whatnot. So I think there is enough evidence to say, look, there's a degree of trust here that we can move forward on. For the Russians, though, why they would go forward trusting the Americans. You know, a negotiated settlement for the Russians at this point has to only be in their self-interest. And I think there are a couple reasons why they would pursue one at this time. But the reality is they've been they've been subjected to the disingenuousness of the Europeans and the Americans countlessly, whether it's Donald Trump pulling out of the immediate nuclear forces agreement or the open skies agreement, whether it's the, say, abrogation by the U.S. of the treaty, the JCPOA, the nuclear treaty with Iran, whether it's the fact that the Minsk agreements, you have Petro Poroshenko, you have Angela Merkel, you have
Holland.
Yeah, exactly. Holland saying that, look, the Minsk agreement was just a means for us to buy time so we can arm the Ukrainians. I mean, like, we could do a whole show on the way the Americans and the Europeans have proven deceitful in terms of their of carrying out what they've agreed to. And the biggest one of all, the one that gets us here, is the Jim Baker promise to Mikhail Gorbachev that NATO would not expand one inch east further, right? You know, not one inch.
You know, Matt, one of the things that compounds all of this even more so and almost takes any kind of a negotiation settlement off the table in reality, despite all the conversations going on, is I just a couple of days ago did a debate with General Ben Hodges. And during that debate, he repeated one of the things that is just said almost as an article of faith by all on this side of the argument. And he says, you can't trust anything that the Russians say. They have violated every single agreement, you know, just like that, that they've ever had. And of course, I could sit there and say some of those things to him. And I talked about it a little bit. You can see it is ingrained in the DNA of their thinking, and they're not going to change it. So if that's the case, then what terms could they ever agree to if you, quote, can't trust anything that the Russians say? I mean, that almost forestalls an outcome.
Right. I mean, just, you know, that's our thinking. And then again, the Russians have the reality of, look, where the Iranians were negotiating with the Americans and the Americans essentially gave the you know, helped, assisted, yeah, carried out with the Israelis a surprise attack on Iran last year. You have both the Trump and Biden administration making a deal with the Taliban to be out by May 1st, 2021 and just blowing that off. Just say it up. We're not going to, you know, and then the Russians watching all this, and particularly the Afghanistan example, watching this and seeing the Americans blow off that May 1, 2021 deadline, say to the Taliban, don't worry about it. We'll be out by September 11th, 2001. The Taliban saying, well, that's not it. We're taking over the country, taking over the country in less than 4 months from there. And the Americans having no any bit of shame, any bit of humility, any bit of retrospection. I mean, do you know anyone, Danny, in the establishment, in the foreign policy sphere, members of Council of Foreign Relations, retired military officers, you know, except for the folks who are watching your program, the folks you have come on, who have talked about this, who have said the reason why, you know, the Taliban took over the country this way was, you know, A, B, and C, and we broke the agreement on and on and on. Has anyone, you know, have you heard any Americans?
Yeah, no, that? To the contrary, what they said was, I know that Trump worked out this deal that was supposed to be on May 31st, 2021. But number one, that was Trump. He ain't president no more. And so it's all about Joe Biden. And Joe Biden carefully thought about this and decided September 11th would work better for him. And so it didn't matter what we had agreed to, what the United States had agreed to before then. It's like, no, this is what we want. So you'll just give us what we want. And the Taliban says, yeah, no, we're not. And
yeah, and to tie this back into the original betrayal conversation we were having, and this is 4 years ago. This is not ancient. This is not Vietnam. This is not the Korean War. This is the same people, or many of these same people, are still wearing uniforms, still at Foggy Bottom, right? Still at the NSC, et cetera. You know, after Trump signs the Doha agreements, and I've seen you do great pieces on this, after Trump signs the Doha agreements, the United States, essentially the United States military and its diplomatic corps, its intelligence services, start telling the Afghans, don't worry about it. We're not leaving. Once Joe Biden wins re-election, we're going to tear up the Doha agreements. So the Afghans are being told all through 2020 into 2021, don't worry about it. You don't have to negotiate with the Taliban. Don't do anything about it because we're never leaving. Right. I mean, and so the same type of conversation occurring with the Ukrainians for 3 years under Joe Biden's administration. And now all of a sudden they're up against, you know, this reality that, okay, maybe Donald Trump really means what he has to say, and we never should have trusted the Americans to begin with because of, well, all these examples.
Yeah, and let's go into a little bit more of the detail here. That's we started off with Der Spiegel talking about what was allegedly said behind closed doors, but even what's been said in front of open doors and open mics is not a whole lot better. And let's start with Keir Starmer, who's talked about this 28-point peace plan about a week ago, and he had some issues with it even then.
Over recent days, I've had detailed discussions with allies. I met the partners of the Coalition of the Willing during the G20. I've spoken a number of times to both President Trump, President Zelensky, who I spoke to again earlier this morning. Mr. Speaker, we're united in wanting a ceasefire and a permanent end to the horrendous suffering that this war has brought to Ukraine. I have always said our aim must be a just and lasting peace. And both of those words, Mr. Speaker, are important, just and lasting. So, Mr. Speaker, I welcome the continued efforts of the United States to end the war and stop the killing. The initial draft of the 28-point plan included points that were not acceptable, but also some very important elements.
That's probably far enough right there, Gary. So it's like, hey, yeah, I welcome the United States, but some of the stuff they said was not acceptable. Now, Matt, that's especially ironic in that there was lots of complaints, and I mean a lot, especially here in the U.S., against Trump because they claimed that these 28 points were actually drafted by Russia and put in, and Trump was going on that. So how foolish was Trump, et cetera. But then here is the Europeans on the exact same draft saying this is bad for Ukraine. What do you make of that?
The arrogance and the entitlement of the Europeans to suggest that they should have any role in this when all they can possibly be are spoilers for a peace settlement is just breathtaking. Right. I mean, the reality is that the Europeans don't have the money to support Ukraine. They don't have the weapons or armaments or factories to support Ukraine, that they have no leverage here other than being a spoiler, other than being, you know, the ones that will continue this thing onwards. Yeah, I mean, the press, both the European and the American press, have been agog with this notion that this 28-point peace plan was written by the Russians because for no other reason than it satisfies all of Russia's maximalist demands. First of all, I don't know about you, Danny. I never heard that term maximalist until a couple of years ago, maybe, and I'm sick of it already, you know, but the idea that somehow this peace plan meets Russia's total and full goals is absurd. There are plenty of things in there that belie that, such as the fact that there's no immediate sanctions relief. That's what the Russians have continually stated, that the parts of Donetsk that are not occupied by Russians right now would see Ukrainian troop withdrawal, but that would be a demilitarized area that the Russians would only have de facto control over. Similar control over all five of those provinces there, or oblasts, would be de facto, would only be informal recognition by the United States, not the full recognition as the Russians want. The Zelensky government would be able to stay in power. It's just a requirement for elections, as opposed to the Russian demand that the Zelensky government be removed. I mean, we can go on and on and on how this 28-point peace plan, or whatever point it's at now, I don't know, is anything but a Russian plan. The other thing too is that which I think maybe a lot of the folks who are watching this are frustrated by this as I am. Now all of a sudden, Russia's maximalist demands, Putin's what he really wanted here was just the Donbas. What happened to Ukraine? Russia and Vladimir Putin wanting to take over all of Ukraine. Isn't that what we've heard for pretty much the last 4 years? That the goal of
coming to get all of us, right?
And then exactly, and that's just Ukraine.
Ukraine is just a pit stop on the way through Warsaw and Berlin and Paris. And if we don't fight them over there, Danny, we're going to have to fight them in the streets of D.C. and Philadelphia and Wake Forest, North Carolina. You know, right. I mean, but now we're being told, oh, this plan where the Russians get two provinces and half of two others is meeting Russia's maximalist goals. I mean, the absurdity of it all is just, oh, God.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, the question is still going to be, you know, what is going to happen now? Where are we going to go next? Because you have Europe still trying to figure this out. You have the U.S. has just left Moscow after a five-hour conversation between Witkoff and Putin. Nothing was really announced in other than that there was productive talks or whatever. There's nothing on the calendar here where anything's going to happen next. We don't even know what's supposed to happen next with the Ukraine / European side of this. Where do you see this going in the near term? I mean, let's just say the next couple of weeks.
Certainly you have those, as I said before, in Europe who want to spoil this. You have this issue with the European Union trying to bully Belgium into illegally turning over Russian frozen assets to the European Union. The Belgians have been very resistant towards this. You know, the Prime Minister, De Wever, has made it clear that this would be illegal, that this is unprecedented. It would put Belgium in a very dangerous spot in terms of retaliation from the Russians, as well as just legal consequences. And, you know, in his response to Ursula von der Leyen, you know, the Belgian prime minister, besides laying all that out, also says to her, this is going to ruin any chance for a peace. If you steal the Russian money right now, if you steal their $190 billion or whatever it is, $200 billion, if you steal that, you are sabotaging the peace efforts that are going on right now. I mean, so you have a Belgian head of state, you have European heads of state who are calling out the desire of the Europeans to spoil this, just as, you know, you can imagine Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, and others.
Jack Keane and some of these.
Yeah, yeah, Jack. I mean, you can imagine how they want to spoil it as well. You know, I mean, so that's the big issue for me right now. I think you have a Ukraine that grudgingly accepts the reality of this. I think you do have that. The fact that they've put so much attention, that the people they have sent to the negotiations, they understand, I think, that the Americans are serious about walking away. And I think they also understand the true capacity of the Europeans, that, again, all the Europeans can provide is just to spoil this thing. They can't keep the Ukraine in the war the way that the Americans can. And for the Russians, I think, you know, it satisfies the goals to a degree. It satisfies what became the territorial goals to a degree that were established in the fall of 2022. It gets Russia out of a war that is going in their favor right now. But I think anyone who's a student of history and warfare, as the Russians are, know that there's no certainty in warfare. It allows them to refocus then on other aspects of their economy and society, other than putting, you know, a third of their budget into this war, right? And this is a war that I think many of us estimate Russian leadership, Vladimir Putin and others, certainly there were Russians who wanted this war, but I don't think Putin really did. And when they engage in it, when they launch it, the idea is just to get those negotiations right away, not to be stuck in this four-year war. This was never the goal, you know, and their goal is not the conquest of Ukraine. So I think there may be some aspects to this for the Russians where they say, you know what, this is a good deal for us. We can go forward with this. Particularly, I think, where I would argue to the Russians, is this a pathway then to achieve your larger national security objectives? Well, your conversation for a decade and a half has been about the danger of NATO. Continuation of this war may lead you to that very war that you don't want, right? This war ostensibly is launched to prevent a future war with NATO. By hanging into this war, are you just continually inching yourself closer to that war that you didn't want to begin with? But the idea as well, too, is that can this get into some type of grand bargain? You know, the national security, the national security
Can you tell us a little bit more about exactly what was so troubling?
Sure, we get some audio in the background there.
Yeah. But the issues of national security the Russians brought up, such as the American missile systems in Romania and Poland, those types of things. Can that be what is included in a grand bargain that either is a part of this peace process or something that comes out of it? And thus the Russians are then meeting what they're saying their national security requirements or interests are. So I think, there is an aspect to this where the Russians would be willing to engage in this in good faith, but they're not going to be taken. They are dominant. Pressure on Vladimir Putin comes from his right. It comes from those nationalists who have been saying for the last 4 years, you haven't been fighting this war hard enough. You're embarrassing us. How come you haven't won this war yet? I mean, so does Vladimir Putin, who is popular and the war remains popular, does he have the political capital to say, this is enough for us? This is good enough for us. We're stopping the war. Is he able to do that? And then does Zelensky have the good sense and the ability to arrange something with the Americans to protect himself and keep himself in power if he agrees to this deal, which, many in Ukraine on the far right, the ultranationalists, neo-Nazis will say is a betrayal.
You had me going there for a second, man. Then you said if he has the good sense, and I didn't hear anything that came after what you said.
That's why I used the qualifier. Yeah, the key word in that sentence is if.
That's a good one. Well, we're gonna have to wait and see how this is gonna work out. That's really all the cards are still in play right now, and it really it's gonna depend on what happens in the next round or so. And everybody's kind of going back to their capitals now, and they're gonna be talking. And so we may have to wait, another 4 or 5 days, a week or whatever, to find out even what the next plays are by any of these folks. But, of course, it's tragic to me because every day that we delay, that's just, more casualties, especially on the Ukraine side, because they suffer more of them unnecessarily and pointlessly. But that's the way it is right now, and that's what we're going to have to deal with.
Just real quick, we didn't even touch on the Americans here, which many people will say, that's a human, but just one thing about Donald Trump is, remember, he likes a spectacle, right? He wants a stage to be on to announce this peace deal. And what better stage would that be than, say, Christmas Eve, right? So you could imagine the pressure coming from the White House to everyone involved in this to get this done by Christmas, just as an example of the what we're dealing with when we're dealing with Donald Trump, which is such a huge, huge variable in all this.
Yes, indeed. That's an understatement. That it's a huge variable. Everything with Donald Trump is bigger than life. But that's another part of the fabric that goes in with this, whether anybody wants it or not. It's there, and we have to figure it out.
Right.
Listen, in the last bit of time we have here, though, I want to address something that is on the American side, not related to the Russian war, but in something in our own backyard in this whole Venezuela issue. And there's been a lot of things rolling around in the Western media here in the last 36 or so hours and 4 or 5 days, especially the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, is on the hot seat because there's a question is, did he give an order to, quote, kill everybody in these boat strikes, especially the one that happened on September the 2nd, the very first one. That's going on. There's the question of, is the operation itself legal at all, whether there was a double tap or whether the single tap, any of these killings are unauthorized and illegal, therefore. And then the issue of also simultaneously is, are the United States forces about ready to launch a war to take Maduro out, a regime change operation by the guy who got elected for no more stupid wars? All these things are rolling around there. I want to talk about some of those things. And first of all, right now, earlier this week, there was a cabinet meeting between, with all the cabinet members there with Trump. And of course, this was one of the key issues there. And during this cabinet meeting, Secretary Hegseth, of course, denied any kind of wrongdoing, said, yes, we're doing this. It was authorized. The president said I could do it and all this kind of stuff. One of the things that he said during that time was that when it comes to this so-called double tap and the second missile, I wasn't even there. And it was actually Admiral Bradley who was there, but he's a good guy and I've got his back, but it was Bradley who made the decision, not me. And so as it turned out, Bradley was going to be testifying today in a closed session for, I think it was the Senate Armed Services Committee, to where they were going to ask him about this issue. Now, a lot of this has been discussed as we've been on the air here, but Gary has been kind of following this in the back, and he says he's got a couple of sound bites from that we can talk about.
But what I saw in that room was one of the most troubling things I've seen in my time in public service. You have two individuals in clear distress, without any means of locomotion, with a destroyed vessel, were killed by the United States.
Well, that was a pretty short one. That was, I think, Representative Hines there, who is basically saying that what some people speculated is that according to international law, according to the UCMJ and in American law, if you attack someone and they no longer have the ability to provide resistance, and it specifies even in a shipwreck, that's actually one of the terms that are used in there and the examples given, you may not kill that person. It is a violation of the law of warfare. And so according to Hines here, he's saying, yeah, that's exactly what happened. And he said it was very, very disturbing. Well, Tom Cotton apparently was also in that same briefing, and let's see what he had to say.
The first strike, the second strike, and the third and the fourth strike on September 2nd were entirely lawful and needful, and they were exactly what we'd expect our military commanders to do.
What exactly did you see in terms of the video of the second strike? Were there survivors?
I saw two survivors trying to flip a boat loaded with drugs bound for the United States back over so they could stay in the fight. And potentially, given all the context we heard of other narco-terrorist boats in the area coming to their aid to recover their cargo and recover those narco-terrorists. And just like you would blow up a boat off of the Somali coast or the Yemeni coast, and you'd come back and strike it again if it still had terrorists and it still had explosives or missiles, Admiral Bradley and Secretary Hedseth did exactly what we would expect them to do.
Okay, so let's, he said several things there, and I want to go through a lot of the morality of warfare with you. First of all, his claim there that this was legal. So, yes, there was a second strike. Yes, they were wounded, as was reported by the Washington Post, but they still represented a threat to the United States because they were apparently gathering drugs back together from the wreckage of the boat. What do you make of that?
Yeah, and I'm pretty certain Cotton's a Harvard Law graduate as well. So, I mean, the idea that he just doesn't have a handle on being able to read law or read the UCMJ as well. He was a captain in the Army. I knew him in Afghanistan, Stan. I overlapped with him for a week in Lagan province, actually. Yeah, he was the S3 for the Provincial Reconstruction Team in Afghanistan, or in Lagan province in Afghanistan in 2009. But, I mean, this is just preposterous. I mean, the idea that somehow these boats are of any threat, that they are carrying out some type of war against the United States. The evidence has not been provided. The legal rationale to kill these people and murder these people, whether it be provided through an authorization by Congress, federal statute, by international treaties to which we are partner to, which makes, according to our Constitution, them the law of the land. If anyone needs reminding, none of those are satisfied. None of those are present in any of these strikes. The administration has not even been able to give its allies in Congress or in the media just some details, just some information to kind of set us all down. So this reality that these strikes are legal to begin with, then alone the murder of two survivors. I mean, we've seen that video, you know, the initial video of the first strike, where the boat's on fire. So you're telling me these two guys are trying to climb back in and get the boat started again. I mean, they're just, you know, the lies that go on here. But I will say this, Daddy, the White House is very politically astute here by putting the blame, if you will, on Admiral Bradley, as opposed to Pete Hegseth. They're calling out, they're calling the bluff of the members of Congress who are calling for testimonies and impeachment and those sorts of things. We can all envision how the Democrats and many Republicans who don't like Hegseth because they don't want him at the Pentagon, they want one of their own
types at the Pentagon, right? They don't want this Fox News host there. They want somebody who comes from Lockheed Martin or something like that at the top of the Pentagon, or a guy like Jack Keane or something like that, right? Yeah. You know, right? I mean, so you can understand why there's some Republican support for this. And so you can envision them pursuing this and trying to get Hegseth in front of their committees and trying to get him to break down over it, and then ultimately moving to impeach Hegseth and remove him from office. However, you can't see them doing that with Admiral Bradley. You can't see them carrying out the same type of political crusade against a man in uniform. It's just not, they don't have, the political capital, the space, our society.
They don't have the balls, just say it.
They don't have the balls to do it. Yeah, exactly. They don't have the guts to do it. You know, this is a consequence of this hero worship of the military, is that they are essentially immune. That, you know, there won't be a questioning of Admiral Bradley the way there will be of Secretary Hegseth. It's just politically not the right thing to do for the Democrats or the Republicans who want to pursue Hegseth. So, I mean, I think that's what you're looking at. I mean, the reality is that this has always been and always will be for them about politics rather than principle. Because I certainly didn't hear Tim Hines saying anything about the C-17 pilots and the C-5 pilots who flew 1,000 plane loads worth of weapons and munitions and supplies to the Israelis so that they could carry out their genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza for the last 2 years in clear contravention of what, about 6 American federal laws. Where was the outrage then about the law of war? Where was the outrage then about American law or international law? Right. And the same thing goes. You can say about Barack Obama. Where was the outrage when he killed 2 American citizens with drones? Where was the outrage when the American drones were striking first responders repeatedly and deliberately? Where is the outrage when we were hitting funerals with our drones? I mean, and this is the danger that we have here. All of that precedent, the fact that nothing was done about the Bush administration use of torture, about the Bush administration spying on the American public, right? About the invasion of Iraq. All that goes through the Obama administration and they just add on to it, right? So now you have like this drone campaign just to focus on that, or the revelations of Edward Snowden, right? So it just builds. And now you've got Donald Trump. Because the precedent was allowed, what do you think a guy like Trump is gonna do? You know, and so whatever comes of this, if it is just a political persecution, even if they do grow the balls and, go after Bradley, Admiral Bradley, there's nothing that's going to be done about policy. And there's certainly nothing that's going to affect the infrastructure that allows for this type of extrajudicial murder, out in the ocean, like we're carrying out, every other day or every third day or whatever it is in the Pacific and in the Caribbean.
Yeah, and let's get to one of the other aspects that Senator Cotton mentioned there, and he says, Lack, we're blowing up boats off the coast of Somalia all day long, and it's no different than that. It's and was said by Hegseth in that cabinet meeting a couple of days ago. He said this is like Al Qaeda and ISIS, the same thing. They're equal narco terrorist, and so we don't have to do justice due process with them. We don't have to capture them. We just had I showed on a show earlier today where you had Dan Crenshaw who said, when I was a special forces guy, we didn't pat him on the head and do something like that. No, we killed him. If we didn't kill them all, we'd go back and get the rest of them. So I don't know what your problem is. Well, the problem that I have is, and I'd like your interpretations because you've got a lot of on-the-ground experience both at the policy level and at the physical level, is that equating a drug runner, somebody who is running drugs illegally, violating our law anyway, violating international law, and a terrorist who is seeking to be using political or violence to have a political outcome, and they are intentionally killing people, not that they're providing drugs that someone else pays for and then chooses to take, etc. That is radically different in my view. But now then they're conflating those two and saying they are one and the same, and therefore there is no more due process. We can literally kill anyone in this whole chain of events. How do you see that?
Well, and certainly now you get to the point where the Israelis carry out their policy in this way, where, whatever degree of connection you can point to someone in the Palestinian resistance allows you to kill everyone around them.
You know, I mean, according to Israeli media reports, the Israelis were authorized to kill as many as 500 Palestinians if the Palestinian resistance leader they were trying to kill was significant enough. Right. I mean, so you by broaching it in these small ways, by just saying, oh, it's just a couple guys who are out there on speedboats. And for all I know, maybe they are carrying drugs. I don't know. You know, but the reality is that when you allow that to occur like that, then what's going to grow out of that, how that's going to blossom into then extending it to allow strikes wherever you want. And so there is no one who becomes a protected class. There is no requirement to protect civilians or to use proportionate force. So all these agreements that we signed on to, and I have to remind people, the people who signed us onto these agreements were the men that won World War II. Were the men that defeated Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany. You know, this idea that exists out there that somehow only weaklings would want to follow the rules of law. You know, I mean, like, who you're talking about are the men who won World War II. Yeah, exactly. Whether it's the Americans, the British, the Soviets, they were the ones whose they may not have written the law that was left to lawyers and diplomats, but it was their input, as well as the way that they put on trial and executed war criminals in both Germany and Japan, as well as how they carried out their occupations, and as well as what they said themselves about the excesses of that war, why they supported this type of international law that prevented these such atrocities, that made it crimes to kill people in the way that we have been killing, not just under the Trump administration, but you know, in previous administrations.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I'm running low on time here, but there's one other thing I want to talk to you about here. One of the things that was mentioned by Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, was he said, listen, aside from that issue about whether it's lawful to change the terminology from a drug runner, which is against the law, to a terrorist who you can kill on sight, apparently, given the justification, he says some of these people aren't even guilty of anything. He said he produced this from the U.S. Coast Guard. And it says here, Senator Paul, in relation to your question here, I'm just going to get to part of it here. He said, there during this period of time from September 1st, 2024 through October 7th, so very recently, 69 vessels were interdicted in the Caribbean Sea by Coast Guard surface vessels, where instead of just killing everybody, they actually intercepted the vehicle, et cetera, which is something that is authorized to do. This is of these 69 interdictions, 14 had no illicit contraband on board when interdicted. 11 of the 14 without contraband did not appear to have committed any federal criminal offense at all. So 11 of 69 were guilty of absolutely nothing when allegedly we have all this great, if not perfect, intelligence, according to the Secretary of War. That means that we are potentially killing people who were guilty of absolutely nothing because we don't want to go to the trouble to actually interdict them and to find out. We just want to kill them. What does this tell you about our war making capability today?
Well, you know, and farther on in that letter, the Coast Guard tells Senator Paul that of the 212 interdictions they made during that year period, none of them required lethal force, right? I mean, so the idea that you have to kill these people is just nonsense, let alone the fact that, look, the U.S. Coast Guard has been doing this for decades. We've essentially shut down the shipping of drugs through the Caribbean and the Atlantic into the United States. That's why it all comes over land into the United States, because the Coast Guard has been so effective at this. So the idea that, one, that this is going to work or provide actually some type of meaningful or identifiable impact on reducing drugs coming into the United States it's a lie. It's nonsense, you know? And the other thing is that ultimately, if people are serious about this, the reason for all this is the consumption. You know, I mean, if you want to get into like way to actually stop this, you've got to handle the consumption and the idea that prohibition is going to work. We learned that 100 years ago in this country, you know? I mean, so this thing is just built on so much falsehood, so much deceit, so much phony narrative.
So what do you make of that, Matt? Because, I mean, it seems to me that we claim to be valuing human life. We claim to, you know, every life matters, et cetera. But it seems to me that we are on a downward spiral to where killing is getting easier and more comfortable. How do you see it?
Well, I some of it is that these people in power, they like the blood. They like the ability to control or to humiliate or degrade others. You know, as Dostoevsky said, blood and power intoxicate. And I think that's what you have here. You have men and women in power who celebrate these killings. You know, I mean, look at the way Tom Cotton talked about the killing of these people. There is no humanity in what he said. That man's a psychopath. And you can see a guy like Hegseth enjoying it because it makes him seem tough. And this, of course, rolls into his crusader fantasy of himself or whatever he believes. You know, I mean, and you have a large segment of the American population, not a majority by any means, because when you ask Americans, do they support these strikes, knowing that there is not evidence, knowing that these people are not being afforded due process, it's less than 1 in 3 Americans actually support these strikes. But there is a segment in the United States that likes the violence.
1 in 3 is still a pretty high number. This is, I don't care about due process.
But we also have to remember, too, that this is not isolated from anything else, right? So that this is part of the larger play, the larger storyline for regime change in Venezuela, part of a larger storyline, a larger narrative for American consolidation of power, trying to kick the Chinese out of Latin America. It's part of all of, you know, enforcing America's sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere. This is a storyline that allows for those actions to occur, you know. And then the other aspect of it, is that this plays into American domestic policy as well. So on one hand, you've got Marco Rubio speaking into President Trump's ears, saying how this is necessary to get control of Venezuela, control our sphere of influence, get the Chinese out eventually, on and on and on. In the other ear, you've got Stephen Miller, who says that this is integral to our domestic policies, that our purging of immigrants, our purging of Latinos in this country is directly tied into this type of violence. Because that's all interconnected, that the immigrants are part of the same problem that the drug trade is, and that you cannot look at this except holistically. And so that killing people in boats at sea is just as important to strengthening America, to making America great again, as it is rounding up and detaining and humiliating and deporting hundreds and hundreds of immigrants, as well as, you know, of course, abusing American citizens and legal residents as well, which is a huge part of that program as well.
Well, so in the final question I got here, what is the consequence of this? Is it something that we can, like you and I can do, we can just kind of roll our eyes, but ultimately it's not going to make any difference. People can just keep doing it. Or is there a consequence and a cost to it?
You know, I think the consequence and the cost comes from the outcomes of whatever they, you know, look, the idea that we're going to do a regime change operation in Venezuela, you know, and that instability isn't going to spread throughout South America and Central America, just as it did with regards to Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, right? I mean, look at Vietnam, right? Libya, great example. Thank you, right? I mean, that's probably the better example, because we're not going to do an occupation of Venezuela. We're going to do a Libya type regime change operation there if we do one. I mean, but then too, say also as well, the violence against these quote drug traffickers, unquote, you know, how has the war on drugs worked out? Whether it's in the United States, whether in Central America, look at what happens in Mexico when the Americans force Vicente Fox's government to crack down on the drug trade, to send the military after the cartels. Does anyone think 15 years later or 20 years later, or however long it's been now, that was successful? So you think that somehow applying violence to this situation, whether it's the idea of how we tried to apply violence during Prohibition and how that backfired and gave us organized crime, or it's the, you know, the more recent examples of just the war and drugs in general since, you know, Nixon started that. How's that war going for us, America?
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of others even worse that could come from that. But bottom line, it's not good. It's not going to help us in any way. But listen, really appreciate you coming on today and providing clarity on these issues, and just laying it out there for what it is, because we're unintimidated and uncompromised to bring the truth wherever it is. And we appreciate you doing that today. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Danny.
And we appreciate you guys very much, too. And we will look forward to seeing you tomorrow on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.